You are listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Good evening once again, and welcome to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. I am Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And hey, over on the other side of the console there, she is the lovely, she is the mystical, she is the mysterious. She is Lynn Nickerson.
Good evening, Willie. I'm struggling with my glasses here. I wonder who's going to win.
I know. I was watching that, but I wasn't going to say anything. I can see you getting all tied up in your glasses.
I won.
You won? Well, that's good. That's good.
Okay, so how are you doing other than technically failing?
Other than technically failing, I'm doing okay outside of that.
Good.
You know? But hey, what are you going to do? We got a great
go
guest.
Go with the flow.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, our great guest is going to take care of that for us.
We got a great guest tonight, so why don't we just go ahead and give it a shot and see what happens.
Okay.
Tonight on Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, we welcome to the show Brennan Storr. Brennan is a researcher and storyteller. He has written articles for several publications, including the Diversity Reporter and the Revelstoke Current. Brennan first started writing in 2009 in a restaurant review blog. Then moving on to other subjects such as festivals, travel, and people. It was in 2016, though, that one of his favorite subjects, the paranormal, became the subject of his first book, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town, the town that he grew up in, Revelstoke, British Columbia. And Brennan says that if there is such a thing as a reluctant paranormal investigator, that would be him. Mm-hmm. So welcome to Spirit Radio, Brennan. Good evening.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank
Our
you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for joining us.
So, Revelstoke, that is, it is a strange little place. I pulled out a map. And I was looking at it, geologically, and it's nestled along the Columbia River, and it's surrounded by the Menasche Mountains on either side of it, and the town is built in that river valley, and it just looks like it would be really conducive to a lot of paranormal activity because of the stone and the water.
That's fascinating. I'd never considered too deeply the geological sort of, or the implications of the geology of the area, but that makes perfect sense.
And yeah, there's a lot of reports of that.
There's something I'm sort of tentatively researching, which I can't talk about too much, but I suspect there may be some kind of elemental spirit living in that valley as well, but a little further south.
Really? Okay, so you can't talk about it yet? Like, might we find it in a book eventually?
Quite possibly. Yeah, it's something I'm sort of developing, but it's kind of got a, what you might call a sprawl that kind of reaches out to touch things that I just wouldn't feel comfortable touching on, you know. But it's such an active region that doesn't, the idea that something like that could be in the area doesn't seem
far-fetched,
impossible.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd asked me this in 2012 when I started writing the book, I would have said you were nuts. And I think 2012 Bren would have regarded 2018 Bren as very nuts. But
yeah, as you grow, you know, spiritually or psychically, I think your scope of understanding broadens, and this other stuff looks like more of a possibility than it used to. So Revelstoke's claim to fame, they were settled in the 1880s sometimes, and they were a mining town. But in the winter of 1971 to 72, Revelstoke received a little over 80 feet of snow, and it holds the Canadian record for the snowiest single winter. That's kind of frightening. That's a lot of snow.
80 feet of snow.
80
wow.
feet.
And they are buried under it right now. My folks back home keep sending me pictures of the terror in their driveways. And
living
out on the coast as I do now, I cluck my tongue in sympathy, but secretly I'm glad it's not me.
Oh. How long were you there, Brennan?
I'm sorry?
How long were you there in Revelstoke?
I lived in Revelstoke for the first 24 years of my life.
Wow.
I grew up, I was born in 1983, and I moved out to the coast in March 2007. So, yeah, exactly 24 years.
Oh,
and it's funny, you know, I like to joke that I learned more about Revelstoke in the, I don't know, 3 years it took me to write this book than I did in 24 years of living there.
Well, that's amazing. Did you go back there to interview these people, or had that been done before you left?
Oh, no. I did all that myself. I sunk a lot of time for about, like I say, 2-3 years. Most of my vacation time was spent going back and forth to Revelstoke for 2, sometimes 3 weeks at a time.
Oh.
And just knocking on doors. And it was intimidating at first, because I didn't believe at all. I just thought it was entertaining stories. And then I had some things happen to me, and all of a sudden I'm knocking on someone's door quite earnestly asking them, hey, has a headless man drifted across your lounge before? and that's a daunting thing to do.
Yeah. Well, is there a story similar to that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's a house in the chapter. Something I discovered early on was the area around our courthouse, which is an unusually grand courthouse, given that Revelstoke is so small. I mean, the population hovers between 8,000 and 9,000. That area is home to a large concentration of hauntings, and one of them, in the book, I call it the House on the Bank. There is a story of someone who saw a headless spirit drift from one side of the house to another, and this would have been back in the 30s or 40s. The couple, of course, they're passed. I heard this from their nephew. But what's interesting is they regarded it as just another fact of life. This wasn't something unusual to them. It was just, yeah, well, this is the thing that's in the house. This is our house. We don't talk about it too much. We just kind of deal with it. And I was fascinated by that mentality because, again, for me, this is all very new. Or it wasn't. I mean, still new now, but especially new at the time. And so to find out that there were people in the world who just go, yeah, well, sometimes you see the dead guy in the living room, and sometimes you don't.
just another day.
Surprise. Yeah.
Did you ever get to the bottom of it and who this person was? The one who lost his head. Or his body. He lost his body. Kept his head.
I'm sorry, you cut out there again.
Did you get any background on what happened to that person?
Well, see, I sort of differ myself from what I think is the accepted wisdom on the subject. I don't necessarily think that a haunting is tied to a death in a place. And certainly for me, I think the concentration of hauntings in what I call in the book Courthouse Square, which is, no one ever calls it that, but it sounded good. I think it's more about the location than it is an act that happened there.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there was a suicide on the property.
Oh.
But that was a very, very long time ago. Or I should say very long time ago. It doesn't sync up with, that death doesn't sync up with the headless vision. But there was what you would call, I guess, almost a hat man apparition seen upstairs in that house over a number of times over the course of years. But what I find fascinating is that the family, they believed it was the spirit of their grandfather who had killed himself on the property. Because at one point he had been a cattle, he would go on these long cattle drives down in Montana.
Oh.
And before he left, he would wear this black hat and long black coat. So when they would see this thing, they assumed it was their granddad. And so, but at the same time, of course, you have all these hat man stories. So it's hard to know whether it was truly their grandfather, and they just were never able to see his face, or if it was one of these apparitions called the Hat Man, which ordinarily terrify people, but because they
assumed,
thought it was something else, yeah, they were never afraid of it.
Well, let me see. Now, you didn't really believe, but you did have quite a few experiences. There was your mother's house, and then there was Bocce's grocery store. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened at Bocce's and then at your mother's house?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, my first, what you might call interaction with spirit or with, I don't know, with things that we cannot see, with things that exist but we cannot see, was when I was a little kid. And I remember that this would have been in my mother's house, and I remember laying in bed at the time. I can't remember. I was very, very young. And as I lay there, I suddenly felt hands on my back, just up and down my back, like the, not sinister, but just like they were rubbing my back.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was so strange because I had a shirt on, but I was feeling the hands under the shirt.
Wow.
And there was no one in the room. And I that was sort of lost to me until I started looking into this book. And then that memory came back. And another memory that came back was several years later, and I was, my grandmother looked after us, my mom's mom. She looked after us, and she was big into tabloids, things like the National Enquirer and
okay.
the Star. And I would read them because, you know, as a little kid, there's something to read.
Sure.
And, well, as a, I like to joke, as a good Italian, I like gossip as much as anybody. So I would read these things, and there was, I distinctly remember there was one issue where it described some kind of meditation exercise for people who feel like they don't have enough energy. And I didn't have energy. I was just curious because, you know, it sounded like superpowers. It sounded like comic book characters, you know, drawing power from the earth and things like this. So I thought, well, I got to get in on that. So that night in bed, I tried this mental exercise, which the specifics of which are lost to me. But essentially, it just involves opening yourself up and trying to connect to some external energy source. And basically what happened was, as I lay there, it wasn't late, and I know because I remember looking at the clock, and it was 8:30-ish. I had a little, one of those little alarm clocks with a red digital readout.
Mm-hmm.
I saw flying above me in the dark what looked like two bats, and I thought, ah, crap, you know, the bats got into my room somehow. I gotta go call my mom. But I couldn't move.
Oh.
And I'd never experienced anything like this. I didn't understand. Bear in mind, I had not been asleep at all. I was just lying on my bed. And then, without warning, out of nowhere, these bats stop swirling above me, and they fly into me or through me.
Oh.
And I remember feeling as though electricity were coursing throughout my body. And then I just fell asleep. And I don't know for sure, but based on experiences I've had since then, I suspect that happened the summer that I had a major shift in my personality when I was a child. Because I went from being a very outgoing, very, I hate the word jocular, but I suppose that's very appropriate. I was a very very goofy child. And over the course of one summer, I want to say it was between grades 4 and 5, I suddenly became very quiet and morose.
Really?
And as I had a similar encounter to this years later that preceded an enormous bout of depression, I kind of wonder if this was the turning point. But again, it's so far back, I can't say that with any kind of certainty because I can't pinpoint the actual date.
You know, that doesn't surprise me because meditating like that, apparently you weren't taught any sort of ritual to protect yourself. So the bats could have had dark energy.
I think that was very much the case because it was in the last four or five years, I ran into a fellow who I've gotten to know. He used to busk, or I should say he used to panhandle for change down on the street, and I would stop and chat with him on my way to work. Sometimes I'd sit with him for a bit. And one day he described to me, we were discussing his struggles with addiction and how he had been clean for quite some time. But he described to me this day when he felt like he was going to relapse. Things were going bad with his girlfriend. He himself was just desperately wanted. I can't remember what his addiction was to, but he desperately wanted that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wandered into a church, and he's not a particularly religious person, but he said he just begged for any kind of help because he didn't want this thing. And as he sort of reached what you might call the crescendo of his emotion, he saw these two bat-like things fly out of his chest.
Out of his chest? Wow.
Out of his chest. Hmm. And disappear once they reached about arm's length away. And then that craving, that feeling was gone.
Oh, that's amazing. That's an interesting
and
story.
So that hearing that really made me rethink my experience because I decided it was some kind of dream, or yeah, I'd written it off as you do strange things that don't fit your experience, but knowing that someone else had a similar experience, that changed my perspective. And that really has been my sort of a repeated experience for me, is just having these, meeting people who had things happen which are very similar, and thinking, okay, so this is not just me.
Yeah, and it's not a dream. Oh, that's fascinating. You know, the hand story, I had something similar happen to me. I had a hand grip me at the back of my neck when I was 6 years old
and, oh, wow.
And force my face into the pillow so that I couldn't breathe. And so everybody says, were you awake? Absolutely, I was awake. And I flipped around. As soon as the hand was released, I flipped around. There was, of course, nothing in the room. But it scared the daylights out of me, and I wouldn't talk about it. I think until I was in my teens. It scared me so much.
Wow. That is, yeah, that's incredible. Yes. And that's the thing. I mean, people will obviously, they want to default to the, oh, you were sleeping model.
Yeah.
Or you didn't know you were sleeping model. But if they haven't had the experience, it's hard to explain to them, no, that's not what happened.
Yeah. It was real. Yeah.
I mean, there is a house here in Victoria, which I there's a very long story to it, and I don't know that we have the time for that, but suffice it to say that I don't go there anymore. I don't go anywhere near there anymore, because things follow you home.
That is absolutely true. That can happen. I'm glad you're wise to that.
I went there was 2013. I told my mother-in-law stories about this house, and she wanted to see it. And I had felt like maybe I shouldn't be there, but I thought, no, I'm just being dramatic. I'll take her in the daytime. I'll show it to her from the bottom of the street, from a distance away.
Mm-hmm.
And the house itself was an unremarkable little bungalow. To look at it, you wouldn't know there was anything unusual about it. And she saw the house. She was quite disappointed. And that was the end. But then that night, I was about 2 in the morning. My wife was in our bedroom. My mother-in-law was in the spare bedroom. And I was laying on the sofa in the light of the Christmas lights. That was the only light that was on.
Yeah.
And I was just really kind of zeroed into my phone. I was browsing around. And so I was so into that that when the figure stepped out of the hallway right next to me, I jumped. And just because it was startling, but I assumed it was my wife because she had recently cut her hair quite short, and so it was fuzzy on top. And so I just thought it was her coming to get me, because sometimes, you know, if I'm not in bed by 2 or something, she'll come kick me and make sure I haven't fallen asleep on the couch. But it wasn't her. It was a shadow figure. And it is at this point that my recollection of the event divides into two, because I was awake. I was awake when it stepped out of the hallway. And then all of a sudden, I don't even remember the transition period. I'm lying flat on my back. This thing is standing about 3 feet away from my feet, and it's looking at me like it's trying to figure something out. It's just a shadow in the shape of a man, and it's turning its head to the left. It's tilting it to the left and to the right.
Oh, my gosh.
Like it's trying to understand something, and I could not move. And finally, I was able to scream, and I moved my arms, and it was gone. And I thought, well, that's enough for tonight. So I went to bed, and the next morning I said to my wife, I said, I'm very sorry if I scared you with all the shouting and such. And she said, you didn't make a sound.
Wow.
And the thing never, I've never been by the house again, and I've never experienced that again, but I was most definitely awake when it stepped out of the hallway. And everything after that I cannot account for, but I know, much like your story, I know I was awake.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, and nothing happened to your mother-in-law, right? She didn't sense anything afterwards?
No, she's fine. Everyone's good. Although, interestingly you say that, I was having a conversation with someone recently, and this was late last year in November, and they work in a hospital. This is actually the Revelstoke Hospital. And they're a cleaner. It was about 8 o'clock at night, and they were down in the basement. They were getting some supplies. When they heard voices over the intercom, and it sounded like two nurses talking about several patients. There were three names, they said, but there was one name that was very particular, It's a particular ethnicity, so it has a very particular pronunciation. And these two female voices were giggling about the pronunciation of this name.
Really?
And so the person telling the story, the housekeeper, went upstairs to the other nurse who was in the building. Bear in mind, they were the only two staff left at this point. It's a very small hospital. She went upstairs to speak to the niece and said, or the nurse rather, and said, "What is it you wanted? I heard you talking to someone on the intercom." And the nurse on duty said, "I thought that was you." And they realized that, they're kind of putting it together, they realized that the three names that were spoken were the names of patients in an elder care facility just down the hill. So their initial thought was, they must have used our intercom rather than theirs. Except those two intercoms are not connected in any way.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, they're not connected. So they kind of filed that away like you sometimes do. And she went back to work. Well, she was finishing work about 9:30, 10-ish, when she, she finishes work at 10:20, but she had finished early. So she had to kill some time before she could clock out. And she was, the housekeeper was downstairs in the basement next to the storage cupboard, just fooling around on the computer. When she doesn't remember whether she felt or whether she heard or both, but she felt something come up behind her. And so she stood up, turned around and leaned against the desk, and she couldn't see anything, but she felt like she was in the presence of something enormous and powerful.
Wow.
And she said she's had experiences down in the basement of this hospital before, because the morgue is down there and, you know, it's a hospital. But this was the only time she's ever been afraid. She was just about to leave when she heard someone say in her head, she heard a voice in her head say, "Don't step forward. It will push you and you'll get badly hurt. Step to the side, to your right, and leave that way."
Oh my gosh.
And so she did. She stepped to her right. She got to her car and drove home. But she felt like there was someone next to her roughly about half the way home. And I suspect that it was whoever warned her.
Like a guardian angel type thing.
And that in isolation, that would be interesting. But that's it. However, I know someone who works at another elder care facility in Revelstoke, this one downtown. And several years ago, she described to me this enormous presence that masses in the dining hall in the days leading up to a death.
Yes, I read that. That was really odd.
Sorry?
I said it was really odd. I read about that, and I hadn't heard that before.
Oh, yeah, it's the strangest thing. And to sort of complete the circle, one of the patient whose name the three women were having a hard time pronouncing on that intercom,
mm-hmm,
died a month later.
Oh, no. All three of them?
No, just the one. Just the,
oh,
one,
the one they
name
pronounced.
Having a difficult,
yeah,
time pronouncing. So, I mean, it, of course, it's an elder care facility and people die. I mean, that's mm-hmm, sort of an inescapable fact. But I'm fascinated by the fact that this name was the one that really caught their attention.
Sure.
And this was the person who passed.
Strange coincidence.
Yeah. And another strange coincidence leading on from that. I have heard the disembodied voices of three women myself.
And where were you?
I was laying in bed, actually, in my apartment here in Victoria. My wife and I were in, she was asleep, I was just fading off, when I distinctly heard, at least two voices, two female voices. It sounded like they were coming from our living room, and they were discussing the movies on my shelf, because I have a large movie collection, and they were discussing titles and kind of giggling. And I remember thinking, what is going on?
And what are they giggling about?
Well, not only that, but who's in my house?
Yeah.
And I woke up. The weird thing was I couldn't make myself get up, if that makes sense. You know,
mm-hmm,
I was laying there and I thought, I should go look into this. But I just couldn't make myself move. And I finally drifted off to sleep. And then the next morning, of course, the house was fine. There's no way anyone could have gotten in or left without leaving some kind of sign.
Oh.
So it's just this sort of common through line to these experiences, tying them all together. And I think it ties them together in a way that makes them hard to ignore.
Oh, you're right. You're right. And when we come back, we're going to have to take a break here in just a minute, Brennan. I wanted to know a little bit more about the hospital and whether it's like a cottage hospital and what else might have happened there. Okay, so we're going to take just a little break here, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We're talking to Brennan Storr, and he's the author of A Strange Little Place. We'll be right back.
Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, and we are talking tonight to Brennan Storr. He is the author of the book A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. That small town being Revelstoke, British Columbia.
Right.
And it is a fascinating book, some great stories, very well written.
Unusual stories.
And unusual stories, and welcome back, Brennan.
Welcome back, Brennan. So we left off talking a little bit about the Revelstoke Hospital, which very, very strange. Now, was that kind of like just a small house, really, with a few rooms? Was that a cottage?
I'm sorry, that all broke up.
Was it like
after you said hello?
Was it
welcome back?
Was it like a cottage hospital, a small hospital?
The hospital. No. The original. There were three hospitals at Revelstoke. There was the I can't remember the name, but there is the original hospital, which is actually still standing. It's converted into quite a nice heritage home. There was that, and then there was what they called the cottage hospital, and there are a number of stories from there, but nothing I could develop enough to get into the book. I spoke to one nurse, a former nurse, who told me that they would sometimes see sort of a torso apparition on one of the floors in one of the wings, but nothing real definite beyond that. That was torn down a number of years ago. However, the grocery store that stands there now, there are also reports of some haunting in that building. I was told that a janitor on the night shift quit because he was being terrified by a spirit. So there is still definitely something there in the remains of the cottage hospital. And as for the new hospital, what they call Queen Victoria Hospital, that's a fair size. It's it's only three stories, but, you know, relative to what the cottage hospital was, it's a more modern, sort of modern building.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about that is I had sort of a fascinating experience there when I was a little kid. And I remember my mother was at when she had my sister. She was in the hospital. And so one weekend, my grandparents took us up to see her. And because it was my mother and I was quite young. I think I was four when my sister was born. I wanted to stay a little bit longer. And because it's Revelstoke, it's a small town, they said, okay, well, you can stay a few extra minutes, but and do you remember how to get downstairs? And I said, oh, yeah, you press the button in the elevator and all this stuff. So I stayed, and then I got in the elevator, hit the button. The elevator went down, and the door opened. And I distinctly remember it was like I was looking at the lobby of the hospital, like I should have been, but it looked blue and abandoned. It looked like no one had been there in years. And I remember being really afraid. And I don't remember specifically what it looked like anymore, but I remember this blue disused color, like it was
old?
Like it was old, like no one had been in there for a very, very long time. And I was just frightened. I was afraid. And the door closed, and the door opened behind me, and my grandfather said, oh, there you are. And he took my hand, and we toddled off. And I remember he picked me up, and I said to him, I told him what I'd seen, and he said, oh, well, you know, he said, when they built the hospital, they built the whole thing, but they only had money to use the front half. So he said, the back half of it is empty, and it's just never used. And I kid you not, I believed that up until 2015. And while doing some research, that memory flashed back to me. So I asked someone I know who works at the hospital, and I said, hey, you know, if I go down in the elevator on the main floor, if behind me is the lobby, what is in front of me? So if the door is open in front of me, am I looking at a storage area? And this person said, no, that's the hallway to the operating room. And so I asked, well, would it ever be really bright? Or sorry, would it ever be disused and empty? And this person said, well, no, that's unlikely, because it's always been the hallway to the operating room, and therefore it's going to be brightly lit, you know, because of the hospital hallway. So I explained to them what I saw, and they said, there's no way you could have seen that, because there's nothing that looks like that. And this person said to me, the idea that half the hospital is unused is crazy. That's not true. I think he maybe just told you that to shut you up.
Wow.
Because, yeah, they said the third floor isn't used. The third floor is storage, but the elevator doesn't go to the third floor.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, it was a flash to the past or to the future?
Well, now that's something I've been wrestling with. And so finally, later that year, my wife, she got me a gift certificate to see a psychic on my next visit to Revelstoke. It's someone she had visited once or twice and was quite...
impressed with.
And she was quite... Yeah, comfortable with confidence in her abilities. And so I went, and I had two questions. I said, the first was not important, but I said, what happened that day in the hospital? That's all I said. And the thing she came back with, because my grandfather passed 13 years ago now, so she said, well, your grandfather was here, and she said, he says, do you remember when you were a little boy and you used to drift between dimensions?
Ooh.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then last year, I happened to meet someone who was training to be a hypnotherapist to do hypnotic regression.
Uh-huh.
And he needed to do a number of volunteer hours before he could get his certificate. So I volunteered to do a session. And that was one of my questions again. And when he accessed what you might call my higher self, my subconscious, said... When asked whether that was a life lesson, whether it had arranged for that experience to teach me something, my subconscious said, I don't know why that happened. That was a mistake. Sometimes it always referred to me in the third person, they called me the kid.
Okay.
Said, sometimes the kid manages to be in the same place as these mistakes, and I don't know why.
Huh.
But... what he saw was the memory of a memory of a memory. And it kind of continued like that. And it said, memories are not just chemical reactions in the brain. He said, they're that, but they're also something else. And what he saw was a memory of a memory. And that's just, he kept repeating that phrase and then wouldn't elaborate. So it's hard to say, but I think, I don't know what I think, but that is what happened.
That's a fascinating story. That's really different. All righty then. Yeah, well, Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying. It's an experience that I'm still trying to make sense of. You know, I still.
Yeah.
Again, in my day to day life, you know, I work. I you know, I go for coffee, I talk to people, you know, I don't think about these things. But then you have these experiences and you can't
reconcile them.
You know that they happened. Well, recently I was in Minneapolis for a wedding, and I was out for a drive with a friend I was there with, and we ended up in Elk, I think it's called Elk River, just northwest of Minneapolis. And we drove past a stone, it looked like a schoolhouse, and immediately I just thought, man, it feels like there's a party going on in there. You know, just getting, that feeling you get when you're standing in front of big speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I think there's something going on there, kind of, you know, some kind of activity. And then I thought, nah, I'm just being crazy. You know, let's just go get some Sonic Slurpees and go on with our lives. But then I just had a stir moment, so I looked up on Google, and no, that place is apparently quite haunted. But, you know, just driving past that, I would have no way of knowing that.
Yeah.
But I felt it. And so these things happen, and you, it, past a certain point, I mean, I try to retain what I call a healthy skepticism, but past a certain point, they become certain things you just cannot deny.
No. I think you're going to have to become a physicist to find out the real answers. Okay, then. How about the story about the Thunderbird development that was kind of built over part of a cemetery? I found that fascinating. Do you remember that part of it was built over a cemetery?
Well, the Thunderbirds are interesting because the Thunderbirds are right next to right next to the graveyard. And by and large, the Revelstoke graveyard does not seem creepy at all. It's actually quite lovely. I mean, if you got to be dead, there are worse places to do it. nice view and all these things. But the Thunderbird developments are sort of at the time when they were built, I believe in the 70s, they were considered, you know, higher end for Revelstoke. And they're still, you know, they're still fine, but they're just row houses. You mm-hmm. know, they're sort of prefab row houses. But there was this family who lived in what I call the house next to the graveyard. And they experienced this escalating series of phenomena over the time they lived in this house. And it started very, very quiet, you know, very modest. One daughter had a friend who would come over and he would hear whispering in his ear. And this fellow, he's a very, very close friend of mine. And he's not at all inclined to believe. Well, he's more inclined now, but this would have been almost 20 years ago. He was not at all inclined to believe these things. But regardless, someone kept whispering in his ear, and it was not anyone in the room. And then the eldest daughter would come home at night from being out with her friends, and she would hear what sounded like radio static. But there was no radio.
Hmm.
And sometimes while brushing her teeth before she went to bed, she would see shadows flit back and forth across the door frame behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was quite enough, but it didn't stop there, because then they had another little girl, and over the course of a couple of years, the little girl, you know, she started talking, and she started talking about the man in black who was looking at her from under the table. And she said, he seems angry. And there was, interestingly enough, there was an anger in the house. And the mother, sort of the matriarch of the family, she spoke to me years later, years on from leaving this place, and she said, my marriage fell apart in that house. Because she said, the graveyard is peaceful, but in that house, she said, there is a rage in there.
Wow.
And it just changed us as people. And there was a story, anecdotal, I heard sort of from a friend of the eldest daughter. She said that her stepfather one day went into a blind rage.
Ooh.
For no reason. And just for a moment, when she looked at him, his eyes were black.
Oh.
So it's hard to know. Is it the house? Is it the people? But there's this persistent and escalating series of things that happened. And one of the things I neglected to mention was at one point a glass exploded.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Got in everybody's hair.
Sorry?
It got into everybody's hair, the shards.
I'm sure it did, yeah. They were doing the dishes, and they just put the glass in the cupboard, and bang, it was everywhere.
Mm.
So it's hard to say. But then I spoke to the woman who lives there now, or at least who lived there in 2013, And her experience there is fine. She has absolutely no problems. She was there alone with her little daughter, who was quite adorable, and it was okay. So there are times I wonder if we bring something to a place that either feeds what's already there or attracts nearby things.
Yeah, or some people are just impervious to it.
Yeah, that too.
But Brendan, wasn't it the case where they were supposed to move some graves and didn't?
I'm sorry, say again?
Wasn't there the case where they were supposed to move some graves and they didn't, that they just built over some of the graves?
Well, that's sort of an urban legend. I mean, I mentioned that in the book as a possibility, but I spoke to several people at the city while writing the book, and they said that no, the cemetery has always been on a certain amount of deeded land, and that the Thunderbird properties were never crossed over.
Oh,
so,
that's good.
I would say it is impossible to verify now. I mean, if there was some skullduggery back in the 70s when the development went through and graves were relocated or not, or just built over, I don't think we'll ever know unless there happens to be excavation on the property, but that is hard to say. I will say, though, that there was they have a crawl space underneath this house.
Oh, yeah.
And at one point, they opened up the wooden hatch, which covers the crawl space, and there were deep grooves scratched into it. So I take from that what you want.
That's eerie. Okay, talking about something else that was really peculiar. How about fear on South Road? I've experienced something like that, so maybe you'd like to tell us about that one. Do you recall it?
Fear on the South Road?
Fear on South Road, near the Arrow Lake.
Yes, so that's a really interesting story because, how can I put this? I think I have solved that, but it's one of the sort of what I call the unmentionables. It's something I can't really discuss because of the nature of it. But
okay,
yeah. So there was a family in sometime in the 1980s, and they were driving. They were visiting Revelstoke. They're actually from Vancouver Island, where I live, as it turns out. And they were driving across Canada, and the whole point of the trip was to drive roads they had never driven. It was an exploration trip. So they stopped in Revelstoke. They got a hotel. They went and had dinner. And then they just looked at the map and said, okay, well, where can we go that we've never been? Let's pick a road. And they picked Airport Way, which runs south of town up through a neighborhood called Arrow Heights and then down again to the flats where the airport is, and it would continue down to the Arrow Lakes. So they drove that road. They reached what we call, no one knows why it's called this anymore, but it's Red Devil Hill.
Yeah.
And so they went down there, and past a certain point, they come around a corner. And the area they were in is called Montana Slough. It's a big bay off the Columbia River, and the road, of course, arcs around it. And about halfway around that arc, or rather, I should say, as soon as they came around the corner of to face the slough, they were just full of this. Every person in the car, it was a father and a mother, their grown daughter, and the grown daughter, their grandchild, the grown daughter's daughter. And the three adults who could look out the windows were individually filled with this intense, intense dread. They couldn't figure out why, but about halfway around that bay, around the slough, the father turned around and drove back.
And the mother says, "You felt it too," to her husband. And the wife says to her husband, "You felt it too."
Exactly.
Yeah.
As soon as he turns around, she said, "You felt it too." And they came back around the corner, and he said to the rest of the family, he said, "Promise me you'll never go down there again." And they said, "Okay." They left. Years later, the daughter came back with her then partner, and the road had changed quite a bit, and it just wasn't the same. And so she thought whatever had been there was gone. But what I was, to a certain degree, I can talk about this. What I think they were picking up on is I discovered that a fatal car accident happened on that spot.
Oh.
At some time, it was sometime in the 80s, there was a fatal car accident there. And I don't know if it happened near to the time family were there, or maybe it happened after they were there. Maybe they were being told to, they were getting a sense of dread because this thing was coming. It's hard to say, but there was loss of life in that accident, and which would explain the feeling they had. But that was actually something I discovered after the book was printed.
Did that have something to do with the a school bus accident?
No. The school bus accident, that is actually, that's east of town on the way to the next town over called Golden. And I believe there was a school bus crash in, I can't remember the date, but the corner where it happened is now, I think, colloquially referred to as School Bus Corner.
Oh,
for
creepy.
That reason. But no, that area is, there's not much down there. So there's mm-hmm. you know, there's a few houses now, but there's not much reason, not much cause for a school bus to go down there.
But that family never discovered what the cause of their fear then, right?
No. I've tried, that story I found on someone else's website, and I contacted the person for permission to use it, but I was unable to reach the family to try and communicate this to them. Like, this is what I think happened. This is why I think you had that experience.
Yeah.
And there was a similar experience east of town towards Golden, where I also tried to contact the person involved. And that story is in the book as Rogers Pass.
Oh, okay.
And Rogers Pass is the stretch of highway that connects Revelstoke again to the next town to the east. And there was one fellow who lived in the town of Golden, which is, I want to say, about an hour and 40 minutes away to the east of Revelstoke. Revelstoke's a fairly isolated place. There's the road dead ends north, the road dead ends south.
Jeez.
And it's an hour and 40 to the next town to the east, or maybe an hour and a half. And it's about 45 minutes to the next town to the west. And so this fellow would, I believe he was a truck driver, I don't know this for certain, but he had some kind of job that involved him getting up in the later afternoon, driving to Revelstoke in the evening, staying overnight there, and then continuing on west, doing whatever it was he was doing. Well, one night, he left Golden as per usual, about 10 o'clock, and he remembers driving west, and there was a semi-truck ahead of him, and he was sort of guiding himself by the lights of the semi-truck, the taillights. The semi-truck went around a corner. He followed it. And this was at the point in the road where the road begins to ascend through a mountain pass. You pass through where, I don't know if you have them there, but they're called snow sheds,
yeah.
Which are concrete structures designed to keep avalanches off the roads.
Mm-hmm.
And he expected the road to go up, but when he came around the corner, there was no truck. And the road was going down, and he had this intense feeling of disorientation. And then he looked at the clock, and he realized that more than an hour had passed, maybe even more than two. And then he saw a sign that said, Revelstoke, 15 kilometers. He had covered an hour's worth of territory, if not more, but had no recollection of it whatsoever.
Wow.
And he thought that was unusual, but he thought, well, you know, maybe I just zoned out. You know, I mean, it's not impossible to do, although I would say on that road, you know, you kind of need to keep your wits about you. It's not very well kept.
Yeah.
But either way, he went to Revelstoke, got a hotel, and just continued on as usual. However, from that point, he began to be plagued by terrible, terrible nightmares. And in those nightmares, he's always on that same stretch of road. And he's always driving, and he's always seeing those taillights go around the bend ahead of him. But in the dream, those taillights come back, and they fly up over the car, and the car is bathed in red light, and he feels this intense pressure on his chest, and then he wakes up. And from that point, from the point of having this experience, he has never again been able to drive that road by himself at night. He has driven it once again. He's driven it once in the daytime. He was sort of on a constant, the edge of panic the entire time, and he felt as though he needed to keep the vehicle ahead of him in sight the entire journey. He couldn't stomach the idea of being alone on that road. And as I understand it, according to the story I found, he now gets from east to west using the Crow's Nest Highway, which is incredibly out of the way. For someone to go that much, to add that much extra time to his trip, and we're talking a number of hours, it must have been a serious trauma. But he is just not certain as to what happened. And I tried to reach this person. Again, I found this online. I did try to reach this person. I actually put an ad in the Golden paper.
Wow.
Mentioned sort of subtly hinting at this experience.
Yeah.
And one person did call the 1-800 number I set up. But when I called them back, it was an older fella, and he just said, "Oh, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. Goodbye." So I think maybe he lost his nerve.
You think maybe what?
Yeah, I think maybe he just did not want to think too heavily about that experience again.
Oh, geez, that's too bad. It sounds like an abduction, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, say again?
It almost sounds like he might have been abducted.
It does, yeah. It definitely bears all the hallmarks of missing time. Trauma, missing time itself, disorientation. And interestingly, it's the only story of missing time I found in Revelstoke. But what I found really interesting, and this is, of course, you know, there's a certain amount of this. You have to build in a little bit of sort of skepticism here. But when I started writing that chapter, or rather, of the entire book, the process of writing the entire book, writing that chapter was the only time I was afraid.
Really?
Yeah, I started writing it. I was traveling. I was going between, it doesn't matter where, but I was in Denver Airport when I started, and then back in Victoria. And writing that chapter, I felt as though I was being watched.
Really?
And that could just be, again, that could just be straight paranoia, or it could be something else. I wouldn't hazard a guess as to either, but
Denver,
I can't say for certain is that nothing else I wrote about, including shadow people, including the few Sasquatch stories I had, nothing produced that same level of uncertainty that story did, missing time did.
Denver Airport is a very scary place anyway. There's something weird about that place.
I've heard that, yeah. Mm-hmm. When I was there, I wasn't there really long enough to take anything in, but, I mean, it's got some interesting features there for sure.
Do you think that this guy's experience was anywhere near the section that was caught in the avalanche where 58 people died?
It's hard to say. I know because the avalanche that killed, and I apologize, I'm a bit fuzzy on the dates. I'm more of a concepts than details guy.
December 18th of 1997.
That's when his thing happened. The actual slide...
Oh, it was 1910.
Killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, 1910.
Sorry?
The actual slide happened in 1910.
Perfect, thank you.
Yeah.
So the road itself wasn't built until 1962.
Oh.
So like the Rogers Pass road itself. So it's hard to know exactly where he was versus where that slide took place. But certainly there have been a huge number of deaths in that area. I mean, I want to say 700 or so avalanche-related deaths recorded in Canada from the time they started recording up until the time I wrote the book. 250 of them happened in Rogers Pass prior to 1911.
Oh, that's a lot.
Thereabouts. So the numbers might be a bit off, but that's the gist of it. You know, there has been a lot of death in that place, and so it's again, but it's a question of, is it, you know, the chicken or the egg? Is the energy there provoke this, or does the energy come as a result of all the death? Things come to feed on the fear and the fear and the misery.
It makes you wonder.
It's hard to say.
How about?
But I know that's a very active area. There were anecdotal stories I was unable to verify of a Sasquatch.
I was going to ask
area.
About
there was,
that.
A fellow who was apparently asking questions several years ago, but no one knew who he was at the time, and I've been unable to locate him.
There was some kind of episode with a humanoid-looking, an upright humanoid, but it had like 8-inch long hair, but he walked like a human, but it almost looked like a cross between a Sasquatch and a human.
Yeah, so that was story was told to me by someone I grew up with. So, you know, a lot of these stories are told to me by people I know, but I don't know well. But this particular story was told to me by a childhood friend of mine, someone who I believe, and someone who I didn't realize has a family history of these kinds of experiences.
Oh.
We spoke off air about the music that someone heard, the piano someone heard down in the Arrow Lakes. Well, the person, one of the people present at that sighting, was the father of this fellow who saw this Sasquatch thing. And basically the gist of it was this fellow works in the bush. I believe he's a forester. And he was headed to work one morning. He was quite early. I want to say 4 or 5 a.m. He had his Tim Hortons. And he was driving slowly because he had hit a bear several weeks before while driving to work. And that, you know, that's a real bad scene, so you don't want that to happen twice. So he was driving, well, he's driving in a fair clip, and then he saw this furry thing by the side of the road, and he thought, okay, fair. So he slowed right down. And the slowing down had the effect of giving him plenty of time to look at this thing. And as he looked at it, he saw a humanoid figure about just 5 feet tall, maybe a little more, leaning on its arm, rather leaning with its arm extended against a tree. And it had hair, long shaggy hair, about 7-8 inches long, and it looked very muscular. He looked at this thing, couldn't figure out what he was looking at.
Yeah.
And then it was like the thing got bored, and it rotated its wrist in a way that bears cannot do, the way it articulated itself, clutched the tree, used it as a pivot, and walked back into the brush until it was out of sight, on its hind legs. And he's never seen anything like that. His contention, he firmly believes that there is some kind of forest ape out there. And you know, of course, I have my own opinions on that particular subject, but he was absolutely convinced of what he saw.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's absolutely possible. But it's strange that Revelstoke does seem to be some kind of nexus point, which you kind of indicated between...
I'm sorry, you're broken up there.
I said that Revelstoke is a strange little place, and as you say, it's like a nexus point with its roots in two worlds at once. I just thought it was very well put, the conclusion of your book. It succinctly summarizes the book and what Revelstoke is all about.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do think, I mean, again, I still struggle with the reality of all these things, but I do think it is if we are to believe there is such a thing as a thin spot between this and other worlds, I do believe Revelstoke is one such place. And
we're going to have to hold it there, Brennan. We're out of time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. This is great.
You want to give out a website or anything like that where people can buy the book?
Sure, yeah. I mean, first off, let me say I co-host the podcast, The Ghost Story Guys, with Ian Gibbs, and we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, everywhere else podcasts live. You can find us at ghoststoryguys.com. We publish, again, every 2 weeks. And the book itself, A Strange Little Place, you can find that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available in the UK. And pretty much wherever else you find books, you'll be able to find a copy. And as for me, you're better off if you want to reach me. I'm on Twitter and Instagram, at LargelyTheTruth. And I also have a webpage, largelythetruth.com, but I don't update that very much. Most of what I do is either on Twitter or Instagram or, again, via the podcast, Ghost Story Guys.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Brennan.
Thank you, Brennan. Well, we enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You have a good evening.
It's been great. Have a great night.
You too.
And that's the end of Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience for another week.
And everyone, thank you for listening. You have a good evening. You're listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
In this one of many.